The Pat Kenny Show
with MasterCard. Share in extraordinary experiences all over the world with priceless cities at priceless.com.
This is News Talk.
The important role of a neurologist involves figuring out how the brain and nervous system signal problems, but also means potentially giving patients life-changing news. Just one more question. Stories from a Life in Neurology takes the reader into the examining room and tells fascinating stories about encounters with patients. This includes stories like the painter who believes her left hand is her guardian angel and the man who sees Santa Claus in a helicopter in his bedroom. Neurologist Neil Tubberty is with me now. Neil, good morning and welcome.
Good morning and thanks very much for having me.
Well, when people hear you, they say you've got to be the brother, so we'll get that out of the way.
Well, it's inevitable, to be honest. And actually, I've had people sitting there looking at me. We don't look similar, thankfully for him. But we'd be sitting there talking to a patient and I can see them glaze over after a while and they'll suddenly go, and I'll say, what's wrong? What's wrong? And thinking I've missed something. And they'll go, are you anything too? And I'll go, yes, let's move on. And initially I thought that was a bit of a pain in the neck, to be honest. But in fact, over time, it's become a fantastic talking point. So now it's to my advantage and people actually put
people
them at
their ease. People not say, can you not get me a few tickets for the Late Late Show?
I was going to call the book Any Chancers, because at the end of every interview they say, is there any chance? And I go, yeah, okay. So needs to say, I don't get tickets to the show just for
just to put it on the,
on the record, or else you'll kill me.
Now, why did you decide to write the book?
I decided to write it because I've been talking almost as fast as Ryan for years and talking about the job, how interesting it is. I love neurology. It's great fun, as well as being, you know, it's got its highs and lows, obviously, but it's good fun all around.
It's problem solving.
It is, and it's obviously it's about the brain, so if you're curious about life, death, the universe, it's amazing. So even when I was young, I was kind of, I perhaps tended towards melancholia, but I really loved it, and so I thought I'd be telling all these amazing stories, and not in a heavy medical way, but just to say, look, this is so amazing how easy. Sometimes it surprises me why we're all still alive, to be honest, but it can go wrong at such a small level. But I was sitting around in a coffee shop slash pub last year, and 2 years ago now, actually, sorry. And I was chatting about them, and Henry Marsh, who wrote Do No Harm, had
great
worked in the same hospital as him, and he's very kind to me, although we weren't in the, he was a neurosurgeon, I'm a neurologist. But Ryan had interviewed him, and that night we're having a coffee or a pint, and he said, you know, you should think about doing that and stop banging on about your stories and actually write them down. So it was him and my other brothers and sisters, Rachel and Gar in particular, who prompted me. And so I said, I better do this now.
Now, we're not talking about real identifiable patients. Some of them are composites and some of them are real people, but identities have been changed to protect the innocent and the guilty.
For sure, including myself. I've been doing this since, nearly 30 years now. So I've come across similar cases, if you like, or scenarios many, many times, sometimes many times in the same week. So if you do think you see yourself as one of my ex-patients,
it's not.
It's a conflation of very many cases. They're all true. They all did happen, but there are, I would see many people with MS in each week. For example,
you're so vain. You probably think this book is about you, but it's not.
Absolutely, very Carly Simon.
All right. Now the first diagnosis that you ever made.
Well, the first I made on my own. So I was obviously doing this for years under the tutelage of others. But the first I made on my own, I think the boss was away, and it was a young girl with multiple sclerosis. And as I say in the book, it's a weird fact of life that no matter what you do for the first time, you're going to get excited. And so I did get quite excited, inappropriately so at the time, because I was young. And this poor young girl from rural Ireland, shall we just say, turned out to have MS. And while I was excited but nervous for her, and then I was nervous for myself telling her, I told her, but then she said, oh, and she, as the tears came, inevitably, I said, well, you know, your fiancé is coming up to visit you, and, you know, do you want me to tell him? And she looked at me aghast, and she said, don't you dare tell him. And I said, well, of course I'm going to tell him, because, you know, I'll break it down, I'll break it, break the news gently and be nice. And she said, if you tell him, he won't marry me. And I went, oh my God. And it hadn't even occurred to me that someone would keep this from their fiancé or anything like that. But more importantly than that, most importantly, this was none of my business. This was her life. I was there as a doctor to try and make a diagnosis and help her through it. And instead, I was getting involved. So I was a bit of an upstart, quite frankly.
Yeah.
And I was quite foolish. So I went inside raging and, you know, giving out behind her back, obviously. And a nurse turned around to me and said, put me straight. And so did my senior colleague, Michael Hutchinson at the time. And he said, get over yourself. This is not about you. It's about them. And I thought, what a great lesson. And it's the truth.
And then the nurse quoted, love is not love which alters, when it alteration finds.
Which made it even more almost romantic. I'd never heard that quote before, but I've never stopped thinking about it ever since. So it is true. It is true that love is not love. I'm not sure it always holds true, but it certainly is true.
Now, tell me about the painter who believed that her hand was her guardian angel.
Again, people think of neurologists and go, oh no, heavy brain stuff and I don't want to know. But in fact, it's the humanity of it all and the fragility of us all. Of us all. So this poor young girl, and again, she's a conflation of many. I've seen this many times, right hand, left leg, right leg. But she came in anyway, and she seemed, when I was chatting to her, to keep turning to her left-hand side and looking at her hand, which would flicker like a puppet. And I couldn't ignore it any longer, us having chatted for 20 minutes, 30 minutes. And I said, oh, what are you looking at your left hand for? And she said, it's my guardian angel. And basically, she had gone through such a traumatic event, a family row and everything else about 6 months before, that she started to develop symptoms that were what we call now psychosomatic or medically unexplained symptoms. But in fact, it actually was a comfort to her. And I thought initially, oh my God, she's mad. But in fact, as I got to know her, she's a really sweet thing. I said, does this give you comfort? And she goes, yeah. And I said, well, there's nothing neurologically wrong with her or that I could find. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself afterwards, you know, whatever works. It's not down to me once again to say
whatever gets you through the day
and the night.
The woman who was faced with a diagnosis of Parkinson's and then was grateful for it. Explain.
Oh, I thought that was amazing. Because, you know, as I said, I've been doing this for years. And it never ceases to amaze me how amazed I can be on a daily basis by people coming with stories. So I could diagnose the Parkinson's from across the street, and that's not to show off. But if I can't do it at this stage, God, I must be useless. But the fact of the matter is I could diagnose it fairly easily, but the response of people, their families, their friends, their loved ones, that's almost as important. Their support lines or groups that they have around them will allow them to carry a diagnosis in parallel with their lives rather than heavily on their shoulders. But the point about that lady was that she came in on her own. And I said, you do have Parkinson's eventually. And she went, oh, right. And instead of being, you know, terribly upset, as many people can become, she stoically accepted and said, right, what do we do next? And started, you know, barking orders at me. And I said, great. She'd done her Googling. I was delighted. But the fact is, I said, you don't seem that upset. And she said, you know what? I reconnected with Facebook. This is years ago. Reconnected with Facebook. Met an old flame. I was about to cross that line that one shouldn't cross. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, with this diagnosis, she realised what was at stake in her life on a bigger picture. So she saw a panoramic view of her life rather than a fun but possibly sordid affair, and eventually said, you know what, I need to get back on track. So it gave her a kick in the backside that perhaps she felt.
Now, you mentioned in passing there, Dr. Google. Is that much of a problem for you guys?
It was initially, and I realised why it was initially about 5 years ago, because it was my ego that was being kicked and I couldn't bear it. But the fact of the matter is that it really is actually quite helpful now. So long as you don't overdo it and for
but
any
people self-diagnose.
Oh, massively, yeah. So do doctors, by the way.
Yeah?
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, I know about neurology. That's all I know. So therefore, if I find something that I think is wrong with me, I'll go Googling first before embarrassing my friend myself in front of my colleagues.
If you think there's something wrong with your ticker, for example, you'll Google first before you go to a cardiologist.
Anyone who says otherwise is kidding me.
but when people come in with those kind of things, and maybe they're wrong because it's not comprehensive enough, and yet you know they're going to go home again and do it all over again, do you discourage them or do you say let them at it and...
Well, first of all, I was going to say whatever works again, but in fact, that doesn't work at all. It works against them. But everyone again sees neurology, go MS, Parkinson's, oh, wheelchairs, disaster. Half of my day will be telling people that what they found on Dr. Google is wrong, and I'm giving them good news. And I'll say, actually, you came in with a, you know, sword hanging over your head of MS or Parkinson's, and I'll say, you don't have that. You're just anxious about X, Y, Z, your job, your life, your marriage, whatever. And then walk away, I hope, saying, right. Now, if they go back to Google, I can do nothing about that.
Mm. Things that affect people like, you know, the popular ice bucket challenge.
Yeah.
Did that give rise to more people thinking they might have had motor neuron disease?
In my little and limited experience, yes, it did. I really don't want people to think that the Ice Bucket Challenge was anything other than a fantastic enterprise. It raised millions for motor neuron disease. It was amazing. And lots of people stood up and helped out. So never let me even be perceived to knock it. But what I found on an anthropological level was fascinating, that young men, usually who just had young children aged 2, 3, 4, 5, were coming in saying and worried about it because it raised hyper-awareness, as I allude to. But the fact was, I was wondering why were they worried? Why this? Obviously it was in the news. But it was because they look in their children's eyes and go, I hope I'm there for them. And it's their lack of confidence as young fathers or, and it happens to mothers as well, but it's mainly men come in with the Ice Bucket Challenge motor neuron worry and women come in with the MS worry. It's a weird thing.
Do doctors suffer from hypochondria?
Oh, for sure, yeah. not all of us, but I tell people I get motor neuron disease most Sunday nights. I'm sitting there, if I'm worried, so we all have the fear for going to work the next day, and I'd see a little flicker in my thumb and go, no, it's going to be grand, but, you know, it's going to pass through my mind. And we all have our own fears and anxieties.
Other cases, a man who hiccuped for 30 years?
I know. I was sitting this in the past, this is 15, 20 years ago, I was sitting in a rather loud shared interview space, if you will, consultation space, and it was very noisy, so I couldn't hear him hiccuping. And only when I asked people to be quiet that he and his wife were sitting there, and I could hear this little hiccup all the time. I was going, oh my God, that's, well, I said, that must be annoying for him, but it must be really annoying for everyone else, particularly, you know, the crucial moment of a horror movie or something. But then I realised that he'd got married, had children, and like, talk about love is not love when it alters. This was...
He's been hiccuping through all of that.
All of that since about 15. So in retrospect, he woke up one day when he was 15 hiccuping, and the likelihood is we did a brain scan, it showed a little stroke in the, if you like, the hiccup area, and that's probably what caused it.
Were you able to fix it?
I offered him medication and it would have fixed it, but it had side effects, so no is the straight answer. But what fixed... So it's not always, I'm magic wand, I'm going to stop the hiccups. It's to say, you're not going to die of this. You don't have a brain tumour. So it was worse when he was nervous. So suddenly he was reassured. So there's little things like that that may not seem earth-shattering to you or I, but it actually makes a huge difference to each individual person.
The simple things that can happen, like someone falls and as a result, the personality changes.
Well, yes.
This happened to a man at his daughter's wedding.
Well, his was interesting. Not falls as he did fall. He was dancing to Bill Haley. And jiving around, fell over, hit his head, the back of his head. And so it's all fairly benign. It wasn't a big
deal. Beware of dad dancing is the message.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah. And, well, certainly I've got to the age where I should back off as well. But he did his head, and it wasn't so much that he changed his personality. It was his reaction to his surrounds. So his family, he was just a little bit dizzy all the time. Low-grade dizziness, like a low-grade concussion. But it was upsetting him so much that he became a bit short with his friends, family, workmates. And then he would talk about it so much, he isolated himself. People get bored hearing other people's illnesses, unless you're a doctor, obviously. They'd get bored, you know, the same story, and nobody could fix it. So it was more, not a mad personality change as such, but more a low-level, happy-go-lucky guy becomes a little bit of a narky so-and-so constantly. And it isolated him. And it was really fascinating to see that was fixable with just physiotherapy.
Now, the relationship between psychotherapy and psychiatry and neurology, I mean, you guys are dealing with, if you like, the electrochemistry of the brain and maybe a brain trauma, injury and so on. And psychiatrists might be doing talking therapy. But there's evidence, isn't there, that even the talking can change the chemistry?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I mean, I'm not Mr. Sciencey guy, to be honest with you. I'm very much a jobbing neurologist, but it doesn't take any sort of neuroscientist to work out that when you're talking to someone, you can make them happy, you can make them sad, you can make them up or down, and their reaction to the label, as I call it, that they have of their illness can change their lives. So if I'm telling some young boy or girl that they've got, man or woman, that they've got MS for the first time, it's the way you tell it and everything else that will suddenly make this not a disaster, spiral down, end up, you know, I'm going to be in a wheelchair, which you're not necessarily going to be so. And there's a lot more optimism than people think.
Finally, and we've been talking about your book, but on a general theme, we were talking earlier this morning about the number of doctors who are emigrating. I mean, you, in your time, you went away and you learnt more of your trade overseas. The question of the crisis in neurology, we simply don't have enough of guys like you.
Men and women like me, and I think that I went away by necessity, but also, and I don't mean that, you know, playing violins, I loved it. I went to London, I went to Paris, I went to Melbourne, so I had a great time for about 12 or 13 years before I came back, and I thought it was necessary because I was a little bit excitable perhaps, so therefore it kind of calmed me down. I needed to be a certain age to come back and feel confident in what I'm doing. For the next generation, I think one of the biggest things they're worried about, and I've talked to many of them as students and younger doctors, is they're worried about... One of the biggest things I worry about actually is medical, legal and litigation. And it just seems a little bit open season at times for doctors and like them. And when you're learning and say this part of your job is going to be perhaps having to go to court, perhaps having to get all these letters and stuff, that's very frightening to a young person. frightening enough to me, but it's very frightening for a young person. I think it's an area that is putting people off a little bit. And there's a lot of anxious younger doctors out there. I was that soldier. And I'd like to reassure them that it's actually a great job. And
But in terms of the numbers, I mean, I don't know how many neurologists there are in the country, but you need to double the numbers at least.
Yeah, you do. I hate to be the guy who's always saying resources. But to be honest, I was about the 12th or 13th, probably 13th, neurologist in the country back then. Now there are nearly 35, 40, I think. But we should be having around 80 to 90 to even get close to being able to see all the people we need to see.
In a timely fashion, yeah.
Remotely timely, is it?
All right. Well, the book is very interesting and very entertaining. It's called Just One More Question, Stories from a Life in Neurology. It's published by Penguin. It's priced around €17. And its author, Neil Tuberty, thank you very much for joining us on the programme today.
Thanks a million.